told me not to run away. I got lost in the desert for a million days. I forgot about my name. She took me in when the sandstorms came.
Chapter 2. The morning comes, and with it the pod race. Qui-Gon considers his plan of making another bet, this time for the young boy who may or may not be the chosen one. It would be easy to tip the dice, to take him away from this force-forsaken hole, but something stops his tongue before he suggests it.
Ben and I have a plan of our own. He feels things very deeply, especially injustice, which makes him stubborn. He's passionate and impulsive. Mom and I are convinced he'll do something reckless. What'll happen when he's too old, too scared, too angry to be trained? Danny, Mom, and I would be powerless against you. We slaves have the same mourning rites when someone is sold to new and distant owners as when they die. Would you please allow him to mourn us before you demand he lets go of his attachment?
Perhaps he should not be too hasty after all. The boy might be the chosen one, although without knowing his midichlorian count, it's hard to say. But there are clearly difficulties with just taking him and bringing him back to the Jedi Temple, as Ben has pointed out. And they seem to be managing on their own, with Ben teaching Anakin rudimentary meditation. Shmi seems like a good woman with strong principles. He's not worried about either of them going dark. Besides, even if he can get Anakin from Watto, he still has no plan over how to free Ben from Gardula. Before the race, Annie is seen off by his Amu, who tells him to be safe. His brother, who tells him he believes in him and to use the Force. And Qui-Gon, who tells him to trust his instincts, which Annie guesses means the same as use the Force. It's just that nobody is supposed to know that Annie can use it like the Jedi can. Ben watches the race from Gardula's own pod, high above the other stands, on hand to settle the bets she has made. He keeps his face his customary blank as she ribs him about his brother. He won't let her see his worry, even as she crows about the gory death he will meet in Beggar's Canyon. He wishes he could be with his mother to comfort her, but he never is during these races. Shmi has to seek comfort from the other slaves in Mos Espa. Today she has Padme with her, as well as Qui-Gon and Jar Jar, although Ben is not sure how much the latter two have to offer in terms of comfort. But perhaps he's being too harsh on the Jedi. Qui-Gon means well. Anakin does not meet a gory end in Beggar's Canyon. In fact, he wins the race, winning Qui-Gon the parts he needs to get home, but losing Gardula a great deal of money. She takes it out on Ben, of course, but he doesn't find it in himself to care. Not when Annie not only survived the race, but won! Ben is proud to bursting, but manages to keep it hidden away enough not to give Gardula any further excuse to punish him. Watto gets the winnings, minus the cost of the parts which goes to Qui-Gon so he can repair the ship. It is a very good bargain for Watto. Qui-Gon gives the pod to the Skywalker family. It's symbolic, of course. Slaves don't even own themselves, much less other property. The pod is Watto's. Watto is cruel, belligerent, and harsh, but he is not unfeeling. He gives a part of his winnings to Annie, and promises to do so in the future as well. Annie has grand plans about what he's going to do with the money. He's going to save it and buy Shmi's freedom, Ben's freedom, Kitster's freedom, Melly's freedom, Amy's freedom, Wald's freedom, and everyone's freedom. Ben asks him what about his own freedom, and he shrugs, says, "Yeah, that too, I guess. After I've freed you guys. Then you can already be there, and I won't have to be on my own." What's the point of being free if he can't save those he loves? Qui-Gon, Padme, and Jar Jar leave. Annie and Ben stay behind with Shmi. Padme leaves a comlink with them, with the promise to keep in touch. Ben thanks her, but privately has his doubts. In his experience, free people, however kind, don't truly care for the plight of slaves. They think they do, but in the end, the magnitude and hopelessness of the situation overwhelms them, and they become discouraged and find other, more rewarding projects to care about. He understands them. After all, he didn't give slavery much thought before it was his reality. He hopes they're successful in their mission, that the people of Naboo get the help they need, but he believes that this is the last he'll see of them, and the last he'll see of the Jedi Order. For a moment, he thinks of confessing who he is and begging Qui-Gon to take him with him. He envisions being brought back, welcomed with open arms, and reclaiming his place in the Jedi Order. But the Jedi are no longer his family. He's been away for 13 years. Hasn't ever been a Padawan. His chance is long past. Qui-Gon reports on the first Sith seen in a millennium to the Jedi Council, causing much uneasiness and anxiety. In this story, when the Jedi say they will use all their resources to unravel the mystery and discover the identity of Qui-Gon's attacker, they do not send Qui-Gon to Naboo on his own. He is joined by council members Eeth Koth, Adi Gallia, and Kit Fisto with his Padawan Nadar Veb. Without Obi-Wan by his side, Qui-Gon is just a talented maverick knight who spends too much time away from Coruscant for the Jedi Council to be entirely comfortable with his commitment to the Jedi Code. You have heard this story before. The Senate has a vote of no confidence. The Jedi decide to investigate an ancient threat, not knowing the worst of it has just taken a stranglehold on the democracy they value so highly. A queen stops the invasion of her planet. Padme drives the events of the next part of the story, which goes along familiar lines. This was always Padme's story, after all, and Anakin remaining on Tatooine doesn't change it, not yet. Stubborn, clever Padme, who pleads her case eloquently in the Senate, and when that doesn't work, orchestrates a change of government and heads to Naboo to take her planet back. Padme reveals herself as the queen and strikes an alliance with the Gungans. Anakin is not there to be awed. Qui-Gon suspected as much, but there is no Obi-Wan next to him to exchange a knowing glance with. He doesn't know that there should be. Ben Skywalker on Tatooine did not interact enough with Padme to suspect that she was more than a handmaiden. He was too busy trying to keep his secret and keep Qui-Gon from taking his brother. The Battle of Naboo is won. The Mon Calamari Nadar, a gifted pilot, fulfills the role of Anakin Skywalker and brings down the Rey Shield. It takes 4 Jedi Masters to do what Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon did in another story, beat Darth Maul. Qui-Gon Jinn loses his hand, but keeps his life. This is a victory, even if it doesn't feel like one. Qui-Gon informs the Council of his find on Tatooine. 2 brothers, strong in the Force, stuck in a life of slavery. He has run the midichlorian count of the younger brother, and it's off the charts. He believes one or both to be the chosen one of the Force. The Elder, he believes, has had some contact with a Jedi on a mission. He displays some knowledge of the Jedi ideals and philosophy, and knows meditation. They should be rescued and brought to the temple. But the counselors object. They're too old. If they have lived their entire lives in slavery, will they not be too traumatized or too angry to be a successful Jedi? Tatooine is outside of Republic control. The Jedi Order has no jurisdiction.
The Jedi cannot go around freeing individual slaves, no matter how helpful they have been. It is not an efficient use of the resources the Jedi have at their disposal. They mustn't lose track of the forest for the trees. The Jedi Order deals with situations on a larger scale than individual people and families. They leave the Skywalkers where they are. Even in this story, the Jedi have lost the way. Yan Dooku does not take an undercover assignment on Sereno under the mantle of his pre-Jedi identity as Count Dooku. He remains Jedi Master Dooku, and returns to the Jedi Temple to support his former Padawan and heal the rift between them. He is the one who convinces Qui-Gon not to go rogue and kidnap the boy against the direct orders of the Council, but to leave the boy where he is, chosen one or not. Prophecies are tricky things, and they rarely mean what one thinks they do. There are many good reasons not to take the boy to train as a Jedi, regardless of how high his midichlorian count is. Perhaps if they had found him earlier, but for now, they have lost their chance. Qui-Gon reluctantly agrees. Dooku returns to the Jedi, and Anakin stays on Tatooine. They will never know just how much is changed by these two acts. With Maul's death, Palpatine loses his apprentice. In another story, this is when he approaches Dooku, grieving over his Padawan, who he's now lost the chance to reconcile with, cynical and bitter over the Republic that seems to prioritize the interests of corporations above those of sentient beings. He is vulnerable, and Palpatine starts to slowly poison his mind. In this story, Dooku reaffirms his bonds to the Jedi Order, when, in another story, he cut them off, and Palpatine has to search elsewhere for an apprentice. The beings he chooses never quite manage to satisfy him the way Dooku does in another story, and he goes through several over the next decade of time, none lasting more than a year or two. He does not take Asajj Ventress as his apprentice. His misogyny leaves him to overlook her potential. She finds a home with others who are as full of hatred and bitterness as she is, the slaves on Ratatak, and finds an outlet for her anger. She becomes one of the most feared assassins and freedom fighters in the system. Ben doesn't expect much to come from the comlink Padme left with them, and almost resents her for getting Annie's hopes up, even if it was well meant. She belongs to a different world, one of queens and senators and planetary politics, not their world of sand, labor, and huts. But Padme proves herself to be better than he expects, and one day, there is a message at their comlink to tell them that it worked, the blockade is over, and Naboo won. Annie responds, and they quickly become pen pals. She doesn't confess that she is the queen, but Shmi and Ben work it out anyway. Shmi lets it slip one day that they know, and Padme says sheepishly that it is such a relief to not have to be the queen sometimes, to just be Padme. They all understand the desire to want to escape from who they are sometimes. They pretend it doesn't matter. And eventually, it doesn't. She's Padme, who happens to be the ruler of a planet. Shmi, who has always had a habit of adopting strays, takes her under her wing. And that's how Shmi Skywalker, a slave who's never been off Tatooine, finds herself the unofficial advisor to a queen. Ah, the handmaidens become Shmi's unofficial children. These teenaged girls whose capable hands are responsible for the government of a planet. They do her so, so proud. All of them. Naboo becomes an important end stop of the Freedom Trail. Padme often listens to her more than her actual advisors. Padme looks up to Chancellor Palpatine as a mentor, but she also looks up to Shmi Skywalker, slave in a mechanic shop on an outer rim planet full of sand and very little else. Sometimes Shmi, despite having no actual knowledge of Naboo, Coruscant, or politics, manages to get to the heart of the matter better than Palpatine. Her advice is often closer to Padme's own views, and she is less willing to compromise her principles than Palpatine. Palpatine's eventual betrayal, because of course it is coming, will hurt less in this story. There is a distance there that will take a war to create in another story. Annie completes the scanner, and they start to quietly produce more and distribute them amongst the slaves of Mos Espa, and then further afield. The little hut that they call home becomes an important stop on the Freedom Trail. Annie works the scanner. Shmi, with her calm, steady hands, cuts the slaves open and pries the chip out. Ben offers to put them to sleep with the Force, but most of them refuse. Instead, he holds their hands and tells them the stories of Aramu, Ekrath, Akar-Henil, and Leia that slaves share with each other, the promises of freedom that they give each other, sings the songs of hope and despair they sing to each other to distract them from the pain. The newly freed slaves share the Skywalker's sigh, rest until they're no longer bleeding, and then they set off into the desert, or onto a spaceship, away from Mos Espa. The chips are destroyed, or sometimes triggered on the outskirts of the city, when they want the Depuran to believe the slaves dead rather than escaped. Slowly, almost so slowly that the huts don't notice, the Tatooine economy is leaking slaves. When Annie is 16, Watto is deep in debt, and to clear it, he sells Annie to a brothel on a different planet, without even the chance to say goodbye to Shmi, who is out trading with Jawas for scrap metal. This, more than anything, shows just how desperate things are for Watto. Anakin, through his racing, earns far more money than the shop does. In the long term, selling Annie is probably the worst business decision he can make. But in the short term, the brothels offer a lot of money, and Annie is younger and more appealing than Shmi. Annie has no intention of becoming a sex slave on another planet, far from his mother and brother. He does the only thing he can think of. He runs. The Umavikan have a term, unfettered. The unfettered are slaves who achieve freedom by the detonation of their slave chips. These are people who see that the price of freedom is potentially blowing themselves up and think it's a price worth paying. They have a reputation for being unpredictable and reckless. The Depuran know to be very nervous when someone with the mark of the unfettered, a circle broken into three parts, walk around. They don't know exactly what it means, but they know destruction tends to follow in its wake. In another story, Anakin Skywalker loses his left hand to a lightsaber. Here, he loses it to the slave chip implanted at his birth. In both stories, it's a mark of his survival, dedication, and determination. In both stories, it will put people off, but he'll wear the prosthetic proudly as an integrated part of himself and as a reminder of what he can and has survived. He manages to make it back to the house and create a makeshift bandage until Ben comes home to do it properly. Annie has already started working on a prosthetic. He hides away in their little home until Shmi returns from her trading trip. Then he sets about trying to get off the planet. There is no search for him. He is believed to be dead until he proves them wrong in a rather spectacular fashion, featuring a grand chase through Mos Espa and culminating in the theft of a spaceship. Ben comes to Watto's shop a few days later, limping with one eye swollen shut. He tells Watto that his current debts have been settled, but if he ever tries selling Shmi to the brothels or the mines or anywhere that's not as or more comfortable for her than his shop, Ben will make the sands of trouble whirl about him like a storm that sweeps in with all the power of the desert. As Gardula's right-hand slave, he has more power than Watto, should he choose to wield it. It comes at a price, of course, and Watto doesn't ask what Ben did to make his debts go away. He really doesn't want to know. Watto swallows and agrees. He's always been fond of the Skywalkers, and he is very sorry it had to be this way. Ben has to understand, he never wanted to sell Annie. Never. He just couldn't see any other way out of his troubles. And of course, he is so grateful that Ben sorted it out, and he will absolutely repay Ben by being the kindest and best master he can be to his mother, and never sell her ever. No, indeed. Ben looks at him silently for a few moments, as if to evaluate his honesty or to drive the point in further. Then he leaves. Annie escapes at the same time as two of his closest friends, Kitster Benai and Melly Darklighter, who are also slaves of Gardula with Ben. Shmi and their friend Amy perform the surgeries, while Ben sings for them. The three of them end up stealing a ship from under Jabba's nose after a wild chase through the streets of Mos Espa. It's spoken about for weeks afterwards, and this is the event that will later be spoken of as the start of the Tatooine slave revolution. It's not. The Tatooine slave revolution began with the very first slave on Tatooine. This is just the moment when the revolution can no longer be ignored. Anakin Skywalker has always idealized Akar Haniel,
and now he takes up the role of the slave who escaped and led a pirate crew that plagued the Hutt trading routes. Akar Haniel disappeared mysteriously one day, and while the Hutts claim they killed him, many believe he will return. And until he does, Anakin Skywalker will take up his mantle. Annie is unfettered, and he will steal freedom for other people the same way he stole his own.
Annie, Kitster, and Melly smuggle provisions to the secret underground city that springs up in the mountains in the desert. It's unnoticeable from the ground, but those who live in the area around it know the way. And the slaves sing coded songs in Amataka that will lead hopeful escapees to safety. They call it Haven. They also smuggle escaped slaves. They can't get into any of the spaceports, but there are agreed pickup points that change frequently, where they can meet hopefuls who want to get off Tatooine or to the underground city of Haven. Ben lets them know whenever a location seems to be compromised. Deperon quickly realize that to send a slave alone into the desert, which they do fairly frequently to salvage for ship parts, especially after a pod race, or negotiate with Jawas, risks not ever seeing the slaves again. They start to send out guards, but that makes little difference. Melly and Annie are both expert marksmen, and Kitster is no slouch. When they have enough fighters and ships for a guerrilla force, made up of stolen crews and stolen ships, they start hitting the slave shipping lanes, freeing slaves before they even get the chips implanted, and dealing a massive blow to the slave trade. The Dipperon of Tatooine know the symbol of the unfettered, the broken circle, and already fear it, because they know that destruction tends to follow in its wake.
Those who get their freedom by detonating their transmitter chips are rarely prone to subtlety. Now it makes its way to the rest of the galaxy.